Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. And today you are in for a treat. I was lucky enough to be able to interview the amazing legendary guitarist and guitar instructor, Duck Baker. Duck has a new record, new reissue, I guess we could say, coming out on Tompkins Square Record later this month. It's going to be in vinyl form for Record Store Day, and it's coming out on CD April 27th. It's called Les Blues du Richmond. It's demos and outtakes from 1973 to 1979. Yet another incredible acoustic guitar record from Josh over at Tompkins Square. He is such a value to our little community, and I got a sneak peek of this record, and it's incredible, and we get to talk to Duck about it and a lot more. Thank you to our sponsor for today, Dying Breed Music. Once again, Dying Breed is sponsoring the Fretboard Journal podcast. If you don't know about Lane over at Dying Breed, you really should check out his stuff if you are a fan of flat-top acoustic guitars. He's got so many great guitars from the golden era in his inventory at any one time. He right now has a 1948 Gibson Southern Jumbo, a 1957 Martin D18, and he still has somehow that 1934 Gibson Royce Mech Stage Deluxe that I've been eyeing for the last few weeks. He has a ton more in his inventory. You can call him up directly at 870-818-3434. Lane prides himself on his customer service, so I know if you leave him a message, he'll get right back to you if he doesn't answer on the first ring. And you can check out his entire inventory on GBase or just by going to dyingbreedguitars.com. Over here, things have been busier than ever in our Seattle office. We've had a steady stream of visitors. We've been doing a ton of video shoots. I'm hoping that by the time you hear this, we will have posted our entire Wintergrass 2018 Vintage Guitar Workshop that had Eli West and Kenny Smith auditioning, I don't know, 25, 35 amazing guitars we were able to procure for that weekend. Check that out. If it's not up on our YouTube channel yet, it will be within the next 24 hours or so. And we just wrapped up our 42nd issue that's going to be going off to press and doing all that behind-the-scenes stuff that's boring that we don't need to talk about, color correction, proofing, all that good stuff. Folks will be seeing that issue in early May. So if you have not subscribed to the Fretboard Journal magazine yet, I, as always, encourage you to do so. You can do that at fretboardjournal.com, and you can use that coupon code PODCAST, which will save you $5 off of your order. We are also going to be hitting the road fairly soon. Next weekend, we're going to be at the Artisan Guitar Show, and then shortly thereafter, we are, of course, sponsoring the LeConner Guitar Festival. Once again, that's Mother's Day weekend up in the adorably quaint, cute little town of LeConner, Washington, which if you have never been to, you should, and if this festival is anything like last year's festival, it's going to be filled with some amazing guitars and some amazing music. So I hope to see a bunch of you there. If you ever have any questions about that or need advice on what to do or how to get up to LeConner, you can shoot me an email at jason@fretboardjournal.com, and I can try to walk you through the entire process or at least tell you what I know about the town from last year. All right, without further ado, we're going to get to our talk with Duck Baker. On next week's podcast, I'm going to be talking to the incredible singer-songwriter Chris Smither. So subscribe to the podcast if you haven't yet over at iTunes, as well as leave us a review. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Here is my conversation on the phone with Duck Baker. Where were you at when these recordings came about? What were you, 1973 is when this particular record we're talking about was originally, like at least the first half was recorded, right?
Right. So that's the connection to Richmond, where I grew up. And then I kept trying to get out of, and I think, let's see, I left Richmond and wound up coming back three different times. Which, you know, that's kind of between 1968 and 1973. Which is to a large extent the way people that age are, or used to be, when it was easier to move around and, you know, find jobs anywhere you went and so on. And then by 1973, my daughter was 3 years old. My wife, who was a few years older than I was, and had no real connections to Virginia at all, and said she didn't want our daughter growing up with a Southern accent. We had to get out. And so we moved to San Francisco towards the end of that year. But in the spring of 1973, a guy named Marty Gary, who had, was a local guy who had produced, you know, some sessions for local bands and stuff, booked me time in a studio there, and we made this demo tape. And I sent that round to lots of the independent record labels who were doing things at the time. Blue Thumb, that was one of the labels. Probably Vanguard, and certainly our Hooli. And when we moved out here, then I started pestering Chris Strachwitz at our Hooli, and he said, you know, there's a new company that is focused on guitar players, and one of those guys lives here, and that was Ed Denson, who lived in Oakland at that point, and his partner was Stefan, who was over in England. So that's how I got hooked up with Kicking Mule. And so that demo was never issued. And even though I recorded, re-recorded several of the tunes that were on the demo on those early Kicking Mule records, there's a few that I never did re-record. And there's one that I re-recorded but many, many, many years later on a different label. So that's the start there. And then, I mean, I had never really thought about reissuing that. Except for maybe I was thinking maybe I'd make it available online or something at some point. But when someone suggested I get in touch with Tompkins Square, just because it's a hip little label, I was pitching other things to Josh. And he said, well, have you got any early recordings? Because that's what he likes doing. And that's what his audience likes buying.
Yeah.
His customer base. So I said, well, there's this demo tape. And he said, well, have you got anything else that'll fill out a record? I said, well, these tracks that were not issued on Kicking Mule that were recorded sort of outtakes from various sessions. This Stefan had gathered together and put on a limited edition cassette in the 80s that almost nobody ever knew about. And the thing about it, when we say outtakes, is that in a lot of cases, I didn't understand why they didn't get on the original record. I thought that some of them were better than some of the tracks that were on the original records. But, you know, Stefan was the producer. He's the one that chose the tracks. And no musician is ever going to agree 100% with what the producer wants to do.
Yeah.
So
what was
so that's
the
story.
What was going on in the world? Because, you know, between Eric Schoenberg's recordings and obviously these recordings of yours, why was ragtime guitar for that brief period of time? What was going on in the world that it kind of existed?
That's a very good question. Well, I'll answer the quick answer to why we young guitar players were wanting to play ragtime. The three-word answer is Dave Van Ronk. And then, you know, I remember talking to Eric about this, about how when everybody was saying that John Fahey was the big influence on everyone, and he was certainly a big influence on an awful lot of people, and for good reason. But for an awful lot of the rest of us who weren't influenced primarily by Fahey or primarily by Chet Atkins and that school, it was Dave Van Ronk, and he had recorded what I still think was probably the first cover of a classic rag when he did St. Louis Tickle in the early 60s. So I heard in Richmond, Virginia, when I was 15 years old, a local kid named Rick Richardson picking a version of that. And I thought, wow, that's the cat's pajamas. That is, that's just great. And so ragtime was like, you know, we wanted to be finger pickers. That was our aim. It was before we had this fancy word finger style. And it meant something more specific because finger pickers, well, you could be coming out of blues. You could be coming out of Merle Travis and Chet Atkins. But though those people prefer thumb pickers. But it referred to you were playing some sort of folk style, something to do with this style that developed, you know, from the roots, as we found out much later, in parlor 19th century guitar playing and so on. And, you know, it meant Blind Blake, or it meant, Sam McGee. And it meant things like that. And it meant, it also meant Fahey, who came obviously out of that. And then it also meant Dave Van Ronk. And we thought we could play, we could be like hip Chet Atkins. We could play fiddle tunes. We could play ragtime. We could play, swing. And ultimately, in my case, we could also apply the same thing to modern jazz, which, you know, a couple of other people that started out the same way have also done. So when I think of my contemporaries, I definitely think of Eric. He was one of the people that I used to see when I was touring around and compare notes with and say, oh, I've worked on this tune. He says, oh, that's interesting. I've done something similar, with trying to arrange the same tune, and we would swap arrangements back and forth. I met Guy Van Duzer through Eric when they were both living in Cambridge. Pat Donahue I met in Denver a couple of years later. Tim Sparks I had actually met in the early 70s when he was still in North Carolina. I didn't know Rick Ruskin until much later, but he made a record early on. These were the guys that I felt like were my competition, if you like. And if I saw that one of them had done something real well, I would leave it alone. If I heard that Guy Van Duzer had put together a real good version of a James P. Johnson tune, I'd say, well, fuck, he already covered that. I better find a different one. Or a Jelly Roll Morton tune. And so actually, for me, ragtime, I got into ragtime much beyond what Dave Van Ronk had recorded, because there was a kid in Richmond, Virginia in the 60s that I met around 1965 who was playing ragtime on the piano. And his name was Buck Evans, a couple of years older than me. And at that point, nobody knew what ragtime was. It really got revived and got into the public mind around 1970 when Josh Rifkin made his first record for Nonesuch. And then we had the Sting and so on. But before that, nobody knew what ragtime was, really, except, you know, people like Dave Van Ronk. And so I was trying to play ragtime by ear from listening to Buck and then some of the records that he lent me. I didn't know you could sort of work from the music and try to transcribe them in that kind of way.
Yeah.
And in fact, by the time I heard other people doing ragtime, I was getting more interested in trying to play swing jazz, because that let me try to improvise while I was keeping the bass line going. And I thought that was sort of more fun.
Yeah.
The ragtime thing is a perfectly logical thing for young guitarists to do, because it's very, very demanding for finger pickers, finger style players. And so, you know, that was kind of the standard there for a little while. Ragtime was the high end of our repertoire.
But was it a case of you were listening to these Jelly Roll Morton records to just for transcribing them, or were you guys actually listening to ragtime just to enjoy ragtime music, the original recordings?
Very much the latter. I mean, do bear in mind, if we talk about, this guy Buck Evans was into ragtime, and he was also very much into early jazz. And Bessie Smith and those kinds of blues singers. Other people that I knew around Richmond, Virginia, of course, were into early blues, and I had been into that. And so Blind Blake, for instance, was somebody that just blew my mind first time I heard him, and still does. But it was Buck Evans who would have first turned me on to Lang and Venuti, and I would have heard Lonnie Johnson and Eddie Lang duos, that kind of thing. And this was all in the late 60s. As a listener, I was listening to all that early jazz. I did make an arrangement of a couple of Jelly Roll Morton things, like The Wolverines, which is on that demo tape we're talking mm-hmm. about. So it's on the new old record. And was also on my first Kicking Mule record. So I did that by ear. And I arranged two or three Joplin rags and two or three Joe Lamb rags and one or two by other people along the way. And that was actually the sum total of actual ragtime that I play. But, you know, if you're going to play a tune like Joseph Lamb doing Patricia Rag or something, and then you take a fiddle ragtime piece like Peacock Rag, which was written by, oh, damn it, what's the name of the fiddler from Nashville? Fiddling Arthur Smith. You know, as far as the guitar, you're thinking the same way. It doesn't have to be a classic rag to demand the same techniques and the same swing and so forth and so on. Because ragtime, of course, just entered into all American music.
Yeah.
And you hear, you know, a tune like Whistling Rufus was written by Carrie Mills, who also wrote Georgia Camp Meeting. You know, that became a fiddle tune. And Doc Watson played it. And that's where I heard it and turned it back into a ragtime tune. But like I say, as to your original question, why we were playing ragtime? As I say, I think it was sort of a high end,
yeah,
of what we could do.
And what kind of guitar did you use for these recordings?
Well, I sort of wonder whether we should even say that, because the demo tape was done with the guitar I had when I was a kid, which was probably a Goya or some awful thing like that. Whereas the guitar that's heard on side two is either one of two real flamenco guitars that I owned. I had one that I bought when I was in San Francisco and started recording for Kicking Mule. That was made by Juan Alvarez.
Mm-hmm.
But then when one of the airlines decided to break that, and I was in London, you could still get real flamenco guitars from Spain very, very cheap if you were in London in those days. And I got a guitar made by Antonio Raya Pardo. That's R-A-Y-A. Pardo,
okay.
Antonio. Very good flamenco guitar, and I paid like £200 for it, which was maybe $300-$350. So those were real flamenco guitars. And then the steel string that's heard on the other side was one of Stefan's guitars, an old Martin that I borrowed from him. Jesus. If you can find a picture of from the cover of my record, The Art of Fingerstyle Jazz Guitar, that guitar is on there. It was sort of a hybrid and had been, remodeled to some extent, so that when I took it in to that guy Lundberg over here,
yeah,
and he looked at it and sort of scornfully because it wasn't in original condition. But, you know, it was a pre-war guitar with a beautiful sound and stuff, and generously just let me use that for a couple of years.
Nice.
Because he couldn't stand my guitars. You know, I had a little L00 Gibson, and he thought that was beneath contempt. I wish I still had that guitar.
Was Lundberg's a frequent stopping point for you? Did you go there a bunch?
Not so much. I've always, I know this is the wrong magazine to admit this to, but I've always been more likely to frequent record stores than guitar stores.
That's okay.
Where I'll go into guitar stores and probably start playing all these beautiful guitars, and after a while I get depressed because I can't afford them.
Yeah, records are still relatively affordable.
Just about if you can find them.
Yeah. Well, speaking of your omnivorous musical appetite, you know, you mentioned Tim Sparks being one of your peers in this little subgenre. Both of you guys obviously went way beyond the ragtime guitar thing to avant-garde, experimental music, whatever you want to call it. Was that just a gradual shift for you over the years?
Well, what happened was, as I say, you know, I grew up in the 60s in the coffee house. I was playing in rock bands, but sort of lost interest in that. And doing it anyway, and really started to focus as a listener on other kinds of music as well. Not that I don't think some rock and roll is very worthwhile, but I sort of know what's going on in that music. Whereas if I listen to other kinds of music, I don't know what's going on. And I just wanted to keep expanding. So the other thing that happened that was sort of crucial for me in the mid 60s, when I was still like 16, 17, 16, I guess, people always talked about Thelonious Monk. And I said, well, this guy is obviously where it's at as far as grown-ups are concerned. So I have to go and hear it because I think I'm a musician. And I took, you know, three of my hard-earned paper route dollars into Sears. And you could buy records anywhere in those days. You could practically buy them in gas stations. You could certainly buy them in grocery stores. But so Sears had the new Thelonious Monk record, which was a Columbia record called Mysterioso. Not the Riverside record by the same name, but the Columbia one. And I took it home and put it on with that sort of fearful anticipation you have when you're young about, oh, am I going to be able to understand this? And in fact, I couldn't understand it at all, but I loved it. It took me about 30 seconds to become a fan for life with Monk, because he just hit me immediately. But of course, you know, I didn't really understand it. And the only tune of his I played for quite a few years was a simple version of Blue Monk, which kind of evolved over the years as I started understanding what Monk actually was doing. At the same time, I was starting to listen to Jelly Roll Morton and all that stuff, as well as blues. And I was getting into listening, as a listener at least, to Appalachian music. And so later in the 60s, I would have been trying to arrange fiddle tunes, and I would have been trying to arrange these early jazz songs and James P. Johnson and those kinds of things. But as a listener, I was getting into free jazz. So I was into the very modern stuff, the really contemporary, you know, newest stuff at that point, and I was into the older stuff. It took me several years more through the 70s to start tying things together and get into Charlie Parker and get into Duke Ellington and like that. But I started from the two ends. So then by the 70s, when I was living out here, I would just listen to everything I could get my hands on. I was writing for Coda magazine, the Canadian jazz magazine.
Sure.
So I was getting review records, and I was getting into some shows for free, and it was the only way I could do it.
And who were
your... Go
ahead.
It was at that point, I guess, in the mid-70s, I met Eugene Chadbourne when we were both visiting in Toronto, and I hooked up with him and played on his third record, playing very abstract stuff. Then when he moved a year or two later back to New York and met Zorn, I at the same time had wound up living with a dancer who worked at the Temple dance department in Philadelphia. And I went up there several times and would sleep on couches, rehearse these impossible pieces of Zorn's for a week, and then we'd play and there'd be 10 people. I thought, well, I better keep playing ragtime for a living. Then, of course, Zorn, within 2 or 3 years, was a huge name, and I was still sleeping on couches. But John, for many years, told me, he said, you know, you need to move to New York because musicians know who you are, but most people don't in that world. But eventually, you know, he got me to make a record of Herbie Nichols stuff in the 90s,
yeah,
which sort of, you know, got me a certain name on the outskirts of the jazz world, at least. And now I don't know if you know about that, but I've just had a Thelonious Monk LP released.
Is that a vinyl only?
That's vinyl only.
Wow.
As soon as I did the Herbie Nichols thing, for John, this is, of course, skipping ahead through the 80s when I wasn't making many records, and the first part of the 90s when I was making records that mostly came out on Peter Fingers' label in Germany. and was mostly my own tunes. But then I did the Herbie Nichols record in the mid-90s. It came out in 96, 97. I guess right at the end of 96, I think, is when it came out. And that opened a lot of doors, of course, because, for one thing, it put me into close contact with Roswell Rudd, the sort of legendary free jazz trombone player who had worked with Herbie Nichols, but was also a very, very deep student of Monk. And so when we started working together, then it took me to another level as far as really doing Monk. And so as soon as I had done the Herbie Nichols record, I said to John, well, I said, how about letting me do a Monk record? He said, nah, everybody's done a Monk record by 1996. Doing Herbie Nichols was a new idea at that point. And so then it took a long time to find a label that wanted to let me do that. And finally hooked up with Triple Point, which is a, you know, very small, very high-end label that had previously only done about three releases. And they were much bigger things, like they did a two-CD set of Cecil Taylor, two-record set of Cecil Taylor, two-record set of Frank Lowe, and I guess a five-record set of the New York Art Quartet, which was a very obscure, great free jazz group that Roswell Rowe was a part of. And so they said, yeah, we like the sound of this, and they just released it. So I'm excited. I mean, I'm excited to have a vinyl record out, but I mean, this is a vinyl record that doesn't have anything to do with the kind of stuff Kickin' Mule put out, because in the 70s, records were the normal way to listen. They weren't these luxury items. So now when they make LPs, they tend to be beautiful audiophile things that weigh about 5 pounds and look great. And I never had a record like that before. And to me, LPs are still, that's a real record. You know, I got used to CDs, but they can never replace the LP. The LP is the perfect medium as far as I'm concerned.
What guitar did you use for the Monk album?
Oh, a bunch of guitars. Again, still the Riopardo as far as the flamenco. But one thing I've done over the years I don't own a steel string guitar that's, you know, one of these $10,000 guitars, but a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like going around and, like, for instance, the most of the Monk record was recorded at a friend's house who was living in North Carolina then, named Doug McKenzie. And he had one of those little small pre-war Martins. I don't remember if I put the model number of that thing on the record or not, but I used that for two or three of the numbers that were on there. And then by the time I had done with those sessions, I still needed a couple more tunes to finish the record out. And I recorded those in Italy in 2015 when I was doing another project down there. That was produced by, a friend of mine and a great patron of the arts named Luigi Marimotti, and he had another, you know, pre-war small Martin, and I used that for another two tunes. But see, I really like the fact if you go around and borrow steel string guitars and you have to get used to them on the spot, each guitar is different, you know, and I know most people frown on the idea that a professional musician would go around and just borrow steel string guitars. But the fact is, I can barely get around carrying one guitar, and I sure as hell can't be going around carrying two guitars. And the last thing I'm going to be doing is putting them on airplanes. It's bad enough having to put the flamenco guitar on the airplane, but it's one that I can often get into the cabin. And there's no way I can carry two of them, not at my age. I'm happy to do it that way. And I like the fact that each guitar has given me slightly different little things. And so when I listen to the record, sometimes I hear things say, oh, yeah, and it was because that guitar did this, you know.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah.
You mentioned a couple times that you know more about monk interpreting monk now than you did when you first started out, or that you've kind of, you know, opened some doors. I'm curious what was the revelation there, or is it an ongoing thing that you can't even describe?
Oh, it's an ongoing thing, and I can describe a lot of it. Basically, though, I mean, you know, when I started, when I was in Richmond, Virginia, I didn't know anything about jazz theory. I learned a lot about swing when I came out here to San Francisco, and I hooked up with a guitar player named Tom Keats, who knew about the chord progressions and about the chord shapes for playing standard swing shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And we, in short order, had a repertoire of about 100 tunes. Because once you know how to play those tunes, you can learn them real fast. And if you're playing a duo, then you don't have to be making real complicated arrangements. Though a lot of the tunes I learned in those days, I still play Honeysuckle Rose and things like that. But what was even better was that Tom and I met a lot of older guys that were playing swing and traditional jazz. And sometimes when they had a gig where there was no piano, they would hire us, these horn players, and instead of a piano player. And so, of course, you learn an awful lot then, because these guys, that's what they did, was play swing. They didn't know, well, they knew a little bit about ragtime, certainly, but they didn't know or care that much about playing fiddle tunes or the other things that folky guitar players would have, or bluegrass even. So that was their thing. And you learn an awful lot being on the bandstand with older musicians who are really into something. That's sort of your education there. And so then I learned, you know, the fundamentals of how those kinds of chord progressions work. And a great deal of Thelonious Monk is based on that. But it can take a long time then to get the voicings right. And I mean, speaking of Blue Monk, for instance, I remember when I produced Ton van Berzek's last record for Kicking Mule, he had a version of that he did in A. And he had really listened and gotten certain voicings. I said, well, what he did there is this. So I just took that from him, added it to my arrangement, which was an E. And, you know, the arrangement got 10 times more interesting overnight. Also in the 80s, there's a guitar player in Italy who's a few years younger than me named Michele Calgaro, which would be Michele, last name Calgaro. And Michele made an arrangement of Light Blue, which... Again, you know, I learned from him and then altered a little bit to suit, you know, to add some other ideas to it. Tim Sparks early on arranged a Bud Powell tune, I remember, called So Sorry Please, and then dropped that arrangement. But, you know, we were learning from each other ideas about arranging modern jazz, you know, where you're going to use the infamous flat five or sharp 11, as most jazz musicians would call it now, and how that fit in. And so you have altered chords that are still like swing progressions, but to really get into some of the trickier Monk stuff, working with Roswell Rudd was just a godsend to me, because there was times we'd be rehearsing and I'd be playing something, he'd say, yeah, and he'd walk over to the piano and hold down some insane chord voicing and say, this is the sound you want. And he'd hold it until I managed to find something to replicate the notes he was playing and the effect he was getting, because they weren't normal guitar chords at all.
Hmm.
And so, you know, it's an ongoing process that mostly had to do with learning from other musicians. But at the beginning of all that, I didn't even know how the basic chord progressions work. And then, you know, the difference between how I did Monk and how I did Herbie Nichols was something I had never done until John asked me to do it. And then I immersed myself in it for about 2 years. With Monk, by the time I made the first of those recordings that are on that record, I had been trying to play it for over 40 years.
Wow.
So, and then slowly, you know, putting it into my repertoire. So it's a whole different kind of approach.
Yeah.
And I just sent a copy of that to Randy Weston. You familiar with Randy Weston?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just got a message that he wants to talk to me. So I'm kind of trepidatious now.
Glad to know you're still trepidatious. Yeah.
Well, he's one of my biggest heroes.
Yeah.
You know, and so I hope he likes it.
Oh, would he call you if he didn't or want you to call him?
Well, it's a funny thing. I was reviewing his new record, which actually was recorded 15, 16 years ago. And I had some questions, and the people, this was a New York magazine called the New York City Jazz Record. They, I didn't have enough information to really write the review. And just as we're doing now, they said, well, here, call his wife or send his wife an email if you have a couple of questions. So I did. And she said, oh, well, call Mr. Weston. He'll talk to you. So I asked the questions I needed to ask and told him he was one of my big heroes and mentioned the Herbie Nichols thing. And so he was telling me how he and Herbie were great friends and used to play together all the time.
Wow.
And talk about Monk all the time. He's luckily. So I said, well, I've got this record. I'll send you a copy.
That's amazing.
So, yeah.
Well, I know you have to run, Duck, but I just want to thank you for your time. This was an amazing interview.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jason.
All right. Bye.